I'm going to kick things off with just a quick story about myself. About exactly 20 years ago, in the fall of 1999, I was an undergrad at the United States Military Academy at West Point. And my kind of dream for my life was that I was going to be a doctor. And I had a change of heart after I took Organic Chemistry 1 and 2. And I was really searching for what I was going to do for professionally. And I ended up following math as a primary field of study. And just because I liked it, I was good at it. And at West Point, you have to pick a engineering discipline in addition to your academic coursework, your academic major. It's a historical tradition at the academy. And I was the only math major in my class year to choose computer science as an engineering discipline. And sounds odd, right? But this was 20 years ago, okay? This is how quick things change. I'll never forget Major Phillips, my academic advisor, saying, "Do you understand what you're doing here? If you chose mechanical engineering or systems engineering as your engineering track, you could double count electives. The coursework would overlap. Computer science has nothing to do with math. Computer science is how we write web pages." 20 years ago, okay? The world changes. So I was very fortunate to kind of stumble into that in kind of a data science background, which led me to really some unique opportunities in the Department of Defense and beyond in starting a cybersecurity company. And a lot of it, you know, ended up being kind of AI type stuff. So setting the stage for tonight. First of all, I'm going to introduce our panelists briefly with some fun facts, and then we're going to let them tell you a little bit about their backgrounds and their history. So first, to my left, your right, we have Dr. Sarah Myers-West. She is a postdoctorate researcher at the AI Now Institute at New York University. She got her doctoral degree from the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where her dissertation examined the cultural history and politics of encryption technologies from the 1960s to present day. Sarah was actually born in my home state, Pennsylvania, in the same town as Mr. Rogers, Latrobe. And why that's relevant, when I was a kid, I actually used to think those little those puppets, I thought they were real. So, I mean, little did I know, I was just being tricked by puppets. It's kind of like the precursor to AI, I guess, fooling children with puppets. So, welcome, Sarah. All right. Next, we have Joe Flood. Joe is a reporter, historian, and the founder and CEO of N2 Communications. As a writer and an investigative reporter, Joe covers the intersection of data with public policy, sports, and business. So Joe's bringing a very unique perspective to us this evening. And one of my favorite fun facts about Joe, who I've actually known for a number of years now, we've worked together at Red Owl, Joe coached the National Collegiate Archery Champs at Ogallala, Lakota College in South Dakota. So we have a national archery coach champion here tonight on the panel. Not what you would expect on an AI panel, but who knows? You get your elk tag, by the way, because you know, elk season's coming up this weekend.
I did not. Antelope.
Oh, antelope. Not elk, okay. All right.
Close enough.
Close enough. Okay, great. And last, we have Jason Taylor. Jason is actually a Bozeman resident. He is the CTO and co-founder of Security Innovation, a company focused on application security services and training with a customer base that includes 35 of the Fortune 100, as well as many other small enterprise customers. Jason is a classic example of just the amazing people that choose to live in Bozeman and are doing amazing work really on a global scale. So, fun fact about Jason, he's a novelist, so he has two novels, End of the Wild and a sci-fi, I gotta read this one, Ganymede, that explores the future impacts of technology-driven civilizations. But Jason's real fun fact, he spent 3 months a few years ago sailing around Vancouver Island in British Columbia with two children, his wife, and a small chihuahua in a 1980s-era Kauri wooden boat that was built in Auckland, New Zealand.
The chihuahua survived.
So we have quite the panel this evening. All right. So with that being said, I'd like to pass it off to Sarah to tell a little bit about her professional background and interest in AI.
Sure. Hi, everybody, and thank you very much for having me out tonight. As Les mentioned, I work at the AI Now Institute at New York University, and we're the world's first research institute that's focused on the study of the social implications of AI. And what we do is we really take an interdisciplinary approach to understanding how AI is impacting us in the world around us. There are some things that probably come straight to mind when we talk about AI, you know, your Siri, your Alexa, but there's a lot of other domains where we actually interact with AI systems in ways that might not be so visible to us. AI is involved in making decisions about the content that we look at online. It's involved in decisions about our access to credit, our access to you know, different kinds of social services. It makes decisions in areas as impactful as, you know, if you have committed a crime, how long you will be in jail and the bail that's set for you that can decide whether or not you are able to get out. So we look across a wide range of social domains, and we try and approach it through a lot of different frameworks and bring together not just computer science and technical approaches, but also the social sciences and humanities. So my personal background is in science and technology studies and in communications, and I study the cultures and politics of how the tech that we use every day is developed.
Fantastic. Joe?
Thanks, Les. And thanks for everybody for coming out to hear people talk about nerdy subjects the day after Labor Day. This is a pretty... I've been in a lot of small towns and mid-sized cities over my life, and this is a pretty uniquely engaged group here. This is cool. As I said, I'm a reporter, a writer. I'm not a trained mathematician or computer scientist. I feel like a little story on my background on this is something I didn't realize for a lot of years, but my parents. So my mother works for Stop and Shop, for anyone from back east who knows the supermarket chain. She's worked for there since she was 14 years old. She started bagging groceries on Cape Cod. She put herself through Boston College, bagging groceries at the Chestnut Hill Stop and Shop. Slightly different economic educational era where you could put yourself through Boston College bagging groceries. But she works on the business side of computer applications. And retail stores, particularly supermarkets, incredibly low margins, really ahead of the curve on these things. I always remember the time she told me about, it wasn't Stop and Shop, it was somewhere else. They realized, you know those ScanSaver cards that we all have, the original, you didn't have to cut the coupons anymore. And it seemed like a great deal. You know, wow, I don't have to do any work. But of course, they were getting free data. This is the whole point. And this is going way back, far before anything we, you know, think about now with Facebook. But her telling me a story about how men between 25 and 40 were buying really high numbers of diapers and formula for reasons that you can imagine. So they put all of the chips and beer sales at the end cap display on the formula and diapers baby aisle and had, you know, a quadrupling in sales in those areas. And then my father is a cop. He's a high school dropout, joined the Marines, not educated, not particularly, you know, like from a math, you know, data science, all these things, but an incredible read of people. And a common sense type person, and he lived as a police officer, another place where a lot of great data and innovation has happened, but he had lived reality of data science systems that were put in place to understand policing and things like that better. And those two sides of it were always what was really interesting to me, the sort of academic and theoretical and data science side, and then what actually happens when the rubber hits the road. And so that's something I've always written about and been really, really fascinated in, and happy to come talk about that a little bit.
I've been on one of those late night diaper runs. In fact, you just reminded me, I'll never forget going into Target, late night diaper run, and I asked the woman in the aisle, I said, where are the diapers? And she said, they're right here. What size do you need? And I said, well, medium. Medium? Yeah, diapers are size 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So, yeah, I've been there. All right. Jason.
Yeah. Okay, so I grew up in Helena, so I'm a pretty local Montanan. From Helena, I came to MSU, and I'm an MSU grad. I studied computer science and physics here. And I have a funny college story as well that, you know, from a technology point of view. About my sophomore year, I decided that I was kind of getting bored of school and I needed to do something to like reinvigorate my life. So I took a gap year, which traditional thing to do. And what I did with my gap year is I spent a year climbing. Actually, the beginning part of the year, I skied because, of course, it's winter. And then I headed down to the Southwest in Texas and I climbed for the entire year. And when I got back, I just reintegrated myself into the computer science department. And what I discovered is during that year while I was away, the internet happened. And it was extraordinarily disorienting because when I left, like the state of the art for network communication was like FTP. And, you know, we're typing command line stuff and we're getting a file from a distant server, and that was really exciting stuff. And I came back and people were building web pages. And so it was like a culture shock over the course of 1 year. You know, and we keep hearing, and I keep reading about how the pace of change is not just fast, but it's accelerating. You know, it's an exponential kind of a thing where, you know, if you were to go to sleep for a year and wake up, you wouldn't recognize the world necessarily. And I kind of had that experience. You know, and I'm hoping that at some point we don't get to the point where we go to sleep for the night and wake up and we don't recognize the world around us. But who knows? I mean, with exponential change, if it continues, that's where we'll get. After MSU, I went to Microsoft for a while and I was focused on software security. Nothing really AI related. And when I had the chance to start a company, I came back to Bozeman because I had geographic freedom and I felt like Bozeman was the best place in the world to live. So I came back here and have raised my family here. And we built a company around software security, specifically focused on trying to make the world a better place by reducing the number of security problems for people like you so that you don't get your data stolen, so you don't have your identity stolen, that sort of thing. And we intersect with AI in that AI is just starting to come on the scene as a powerful technology in that field, both on the defensive side in terms of how we think about defending systems from attackers, and on the offensive side in terms of what can you do with AI to attack systems and break into them. But probably more importantly, I'm just an AI enthusiast. I just love technology, and I love AI in particular to the point where, as Les mentioned, I wrote a novel last winter, kind of tried my hand at sci-fi and cyberpunk, and this is a story about AI. It's a story about a series of AI constructs becoming kind of self-aware and what the implications of that are on the world around them. And I'm hoping it's not a prediction for the future because it does not end well in the book.
They never do.
I don't want to give away too much, but I'm not trying to predict the future. I just kind of, my brain goes that way. Like if, you know, things go wrong and everything breaks and it's dystopia. But in the real world, hopefully things turn out better.
Utopia instead.
Yeah, utopia.
Yeah, great. Yeah. All right, thanks, Jason. So keep those questions coming in. I'd like to kick off the discussion with, you know, I remember putting AI and on a slide for my first company. Oh, we're going to use AI to catch insider threat. I don't think I really even knew what it was back then. It was still, you know, a nebulous new thing. And even today, the definition seems to be evolving constantly and changing. So what I'd like to pose to all of you is, what is it? What is this AI thing we hear so much about?
I'll start. And I find this question really interesting because when I was in college, some of you may know the name. I studied with John Paxton, and he has a PhD in artificial intelligence. And, of course, I took his AI class. And we got to do things like write neural networks and write gaming systems that, you know, played games and tried to beat humans. And what I learned there, and I've seen this kind of continue to happen, is that the goalposts of what we call AI continue to change. Like, in the early days, they thought, if we could write an algorithm to beat a human in chess, that's AI. And they wrote an algorithm to beat a human in chess. And when they were done doing it, and they looked at it, they said, that's not AI, because we understand exactly how this works. It's just a very good algorithm, and it's running on a very fast computer. And then it was, well, maybe if we write a bot that, like in a text chat, can fool a human into thinking it's also a human, that's AI, because no computer could do that without being able to think like a human. And they started writing bots that could fool humans. And you look at the algorithm, you're like, this is not actually that hard, because what you learn is there's tricks. You can, like, and a lot of AI right now is about hacking humans. And so, like, the bot writers figured out that if they wrote a bot that made the other person angry, and we're going to hear more about anger, I think, tonight, but if you make someone angry, like, they automatically assume that's a person, and they get into a fight with it, right? And they're like, this is definitely human, and, like, a really frustrating human. And you look at the algorithm, it's not AI. And so I think, you know, we're at this point, we're in the era of deep learning, and neural networks is like the primary mechanism by which people are writing AI. And in my mind, and you can ask me in 20 years and I might change my mind about this, but to me that feels like AI. And the reason I say that is my definition for AI at this moment is an algorithm of sufficient complexity that we don't understand what it's doing under the covers, and we can't predict ahead of time what it's going to do. You've got to run it. And the reason I like that definition is because it also defines humans. So there we go.
I love it. Sarah?
Yeah, so a lot of times when we talk about artificial intelligence, again, you get this kind of picture in your head of like a sentient robot who's able to have a conversation with you, and you wouldn't know any difference between whether that's a human or a machine. Like that's the idea behind the Turing test, which is seen as one of the most widely known tests for artificial intelligence. But what we call AI today is often really machine learning. And so machine learning is essentially it's a set of statistical functions that are looking for patterns in data. And that's AI as, you know, we interact with it in a lot of different cases. And there are some other types of AI, like deep learning and neural nets. We don't have to get into all of the technical details of those, but the point is that what we call AI is often just, you know, looking for patterns and using that to predict trends in the future. But the third definition of AI, and I kind of reference this with my fun fact, is that a lot of times what's sold to us as AI is actually people. It's actually real human beings who are on the other side of an interface who are, you know, classifying an image as, you know, secretly something, or as classifying an image saying like a cat is a cat because the computer algorithms aren't that good at doing that yet. And so I think one thing that's really important to keep in the front of our minds when we're talking about AI is being really concrete about what it is that we mean by that term and not letting it get ahead of ourselves and differentiating between, you know, the dream of AI, the idea of you know, the cultural dream of, you know, achieving sentience with computers, and then the reality of how AI actually works and is embedded in systems around us.
What I think is interesting about kind of what you said, you mentioned machine learning and neural networks and that there's other things. And what struck me is that the most effective AI techniques today all have inspiration in biology. So a neural network was inspired by the human brain. It's trying to simulate neurons and circuits. And the other, like I would say that the next most kind of powerful, most common AI algorithm today is genetic algorithms, which is inspired by genetics and how evolution happens and how DNA works. So I think, you know, part of the definition of AI is we're trying to create something in the model of ourselves, and we're defining intelligence in human terms, because you could already say a computer is intelligent in machine terms, right? But it doesn't necessarily, there's things that it can do far better than we can do, and vice versa. So we're trying to get machines to the point where they can do things as well as we can do in every area, and some of that does not come naturally to them, so we're becoming inspired by biology to try to get there. Mm-hmm.
Joe, how do you explain AI to fellow antelope hunters?
Well, you know, one of the things I like to think about is a sort of historical context on this. And certainly there are things that are happening in deep learning and things like that where we might see real changes of kind and not just degree in what computers are able to do. But I think just as valid is, you know, we had the pleasure earlier today of going to the Computer Museum here in town, which I'd never been to and was really fascinating. And one of the things that they do really well, and it's the thing I think about a lot, is they start with like cuneiform tablets counting like barley yields from Mesopotamia 4,000 years ago. And it moves forward from there. And ultimately, we are just talking about that same thing in a lot of ways. You know, 10 years ago, it was big data. The difference between big data and AI, kind of negligible, certainly when it comes to like, you know, pitches to a venture capital firm, you just sort of changed one, you know what I mean? And whether or not they're actually doing it or not, it's unclear. Before that, we had things like organizational research and systems analysis. If anyone's seen, not so much the Steve Martin version, but the original Cheaper by the Dozen, which is about Taylorism, was a term in the around the turn of the century, the beginning of the 1900s, for sort of scientific management to had to build, you know, more efficient factories and things like that. Ultimately, we're talking about very similar kinds of things. We're talking about increased processing power, increased calculating power that you can use to find patterns and predict things and then sort of react accordingly. And I think that, you know, I'm a writer for a living, and I think there are two kinds of writing. There's the kind of writing that's there to illuminate and to explain things to people, that's new information to them or give a new spin on something. And then there's writing that's meant to obscure or to speak to a very small, very technical audience. And I think so often what happens with these terms is that people are working in a sort of information asymmetry so as to gull investors with fancy terms, you know, and to...
That never happens.
Yeah. to bring some new sizzle to whatever what it is that they're doing, to have a sexy new thing that people don't understand and maybe they're intimidated by, and so they think therefore it must be smart, when in fact it might just be someone at a call center who's doing this, you know, equivalent, who's doing it for you and not actually a bot. So I like to think about that a lot, the ways that AI is not some radically different thing. It's part of another step, another continuum in a world that we live in that, you know, has been happening for, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. And I think that's a really important thing that I think about is so that we can reckon with it and that it's not just a handful of experts making decisions in some far off place, but we're sort of reckoning with these things ourselves and thinking about them in these terms.
Yeah, just to add one point, I think, you know, you talked about, you know, the proliferation of data, and I think it's no accident that we see this boom in discussions about AI that have happened really in the last decade, because we have computational power, we have massive data centers that are able to process data and to train models in order to find patterns in massive data sets. And we're now, you know, interacting with devices and producing all of that data ourselves. And so I think one thing that we might do today is to tie in the discussion about AI in with, you know, other discussions that we are already having about what is the value of our data, and how do we think about our relationships to our data, and how is that, what forms of accountability do we need for our data?
One of the things I really like that you guys, I think, are drawing out is the importance of thinking about the human factor when dealing with technology. And I, as an engineer, like I tend to think more about technology than humans. I can't get around that. But I read this research study, which really, for me, crystallized the importance of the kind of work like you're doing at AI Now. And it was this study about how to inject AI bots into human workforce, you know, and to make teams more effective. And so they did this experiment, and they created a bot that was as effective as possible at doing this teamwork. And, like, as an engineer, that's what I would do. It's like, let's create a bot that's really good at this job and have it help the team. And then they created a bot that was not good at its job. It would make mistakes purposefully and would own up to it. And it was a chat bot, right? So they could all talk. The team, the human team and the AI team member could talk. And on the team with the bot that made mistakes and would own up to it, the team effectiveness increased substantially because it improved team culture. And so people were not afraid to make mistakes. They're not afraid to talk about it and show weakness. On the team where the bot was perfect as a bot could be, the team was less effective because it kind of helped. And this was not like the bot was not leading the team. It was just a member of the team. So it shows, I mean, first of all, just how important personality is in team, period. But as an engineer, I would have made the wrong choice. I would have made a bot that was as perfect as possible. So we need people thinking about that intersection of human behavior and AI, because otherwise we create the wrong future.
Great. Well, we've got some great questions coming in. I want to dive into some of those. I'm going to try to kind of triage them and as best I can to kind of group some of them, some great themes, and we're going to just pull some punches. These are some good questions. Jason, I actually think this one is probably good for you based on the conversation we had earlier today. Do you think that using AI is a good idea to stop hate speech, or I guess more generally, negative online content? Why or why not?
Oh, that's a good question to stop.
This reminds me a little bit of the discussion we had about Facebook today.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the reason it reminds you of that discussion is because what we talked about was when you give an AI algorithm a goal, it's going to go as strong as possible towards that goal, and there may be side effects that you cannot anticipate. And the example that we talked about at lunch today was this whole concept of surveillance capitalism, which is kind of what we're in today. It started with Google, and it kind of cross-pollinated to Facebook and to YouTube and stuff like that. And on a platform like Facebook or YouTube, the goal of that platform is for you as a user to be as engaged as possible. Because the more engaged you are, the more they can monetize your data, monetize you. So they want you, you know, clicking as many videos as possible, spending as much time as possible, commenting, clicking like, just interacting, because that's engagement. It's a metric they track. So you know, they spent a lot of money in AI, and they spent a lot of money on trying to drive engagement. And so they have algorithms. They basically, you know, you can imagine Zuckerberg. He's telling his engineering team, drive engagement. That's your number one priority. Use the AI, drive engagement. So they built algorithms to do this, and it was hugely effective. And what happened is the algorithms discovered that the best way to drive engagement is to make people mad. And the angrier you are, the more likely you are to comment on that thing or to click on the next video or to keep going on that platform, because nothing drives engagement with a human being more than anger, for the most part. You know, we all have individual differences. And that was not a side effect that they necessarily anticipated. So the algorithm optimized for engagement, and what they ended up with was anger. So I would say a similar answer to the question you asked is, what's the side effect of trying to curtail hate speech? Is how do you define it? How do you know when you see it? And what do you do when that AI goes overboard, and what else is it curtailing? And what does that do to discourse in general if people are afraid to speak because they don't know if what they're saying will be interpreted in a way that has perhaps social consequences, right? If they're labeled as someone who is participating in hate speech when they don't, that's one of the main things about AI is the black box. Once you set it loose, you don't necessarily know how it's making the decisions it's making. So it's not like you could tell somebody, this is what defines hate speech. It would be the AI that says, you're doing hate speech, and maybe you don't know why or how, or how'd you get there? And what's the impact on you and just your ability to express yourself, and then also on your own social capital if you're labeled as someone who participates in hate speech. So that would be my concern.
Sarah, did you have something to add?
I do. So I think my running theme for tonight is going to be AI as humans. So I think that we're already there. And we're not there necessarily because we have AI that's particularly good at handling hate speech, but because we have human content moderators who are being asked to curate content, and they're all like, they've always been curating content. Platforms have always been engaged in content moderation. There are very few platforms that have taken a full hands-off, and it's just like 4chan and 8chan. Content moderators are working in, you know, very taxing conditions. They're working out of call centers. They're paid very low wages, and they're asked to curate content very, very rapidly. And they're not given context to really consider, you know, is this hate speech? Is this something that, you know, what is it in the context of a larger discussion? Often they're only able to see the single post. They can't see the context surrounding it, and they don't have time for evaluation. They're asked essentially to perform algorithmic curation. If an algorithm, like a definition for an algorithm is basically like it's a recipe, it's a set of instructions that you need to follow. And human content moderators are doing that work. They're doing that labor. They're applying very granular logic to acting on posts. And it is black box. We don't have much information about how, like, what those granular instructions look like from companies. We're getting a little bit more than we used to have, but...
And it can be traumatizing for the operators, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one area where I actually think that, you know, AI could be really helpful because it's, you know, all of the issues of precarity aside, it's really hard to look at, you know, they're essentially like performing a profound service to all of us by looking at some of the worst stuff out there on the internet. It is brutal. And so if we can automate some of that, that's helpful just because it's, you know, for humane reasons. But, you know, we have a long way to go before AI can do that effectively. And it's, you know, I would argue that it's really hard for humans to do that effectively. And moreover, there are a couple instances where people have tried to develop, you know, AI hate speech detection, and some of the research on that has shown that hate speech is defined in ways that tend to disproportionately impact the communities that are whose speech is already marginalized. So it's like the speech of communities of color that tends to get policed much more stringently or treated as hate speech than those who experience privilege.
Yeah. So you'd say it's like a way of augmenting human labor, that the AI algorithm can make that first cut and then humans have to do less work to...
Potentially, yeah. I mean, I think that the way, you know, there's a variety of different ways that AI is applied for content moderation. Usually it takes the edge cases, the ones that are really easy, and humans have to handle the stuff in the middle. You also see AI used for amplification. So if, let's say, it's harder in hate speech, but if you're looking at, you know, pornography, particularly like images of children being abused, where, you know, there are you know that an image needs to be taken down, they can, you know, use image hashing to find it elsewhere on the platform and take it down at scale. Like there's AI being used in those kinds of systems already.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it speaks to one of the complications where you said that, you know, you can set an AI to do a specific thing, but how that limited task and limited purview fits into the broadest and most complicated of questions is a very different thing when you're talking about speech and things like that. You know, we can write algorithms to beat any human at chess. Can you write one to beat any human at chess and be the most popular kid in high school, right? Like, as that's these are the kinds of worlds we live in that are so different from these very limited sort of logistical operational things. And that's, we now are in this place where all of this very technical stuff has become a part of a very broad universe of communication and life and politics and economics, that it is not, and that fit is not very good, and we're dealing with, you know, the ramifications of it.
Joe, while you got the mic, I got another question for you. Since you're the investigative journalist, you get the fake news question. At a previous symposium event, there was a reference to the intersection of AI and online fake news. What are the threats and opportunities related to the intersection of AI and fake news?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of opportunities, it's very similar to what we're talking about with, you know, images and things like that. There are definite traits in fake news. And by fake news, I'm using a sort of traditional definition, i.e. things that are really made up. Not like the opinions are different from mine, or but things that are just made up false stuff. And these tend to be, you know, they're pretty easily identifiable in certain ways, in sort of in machine learning ways. One, they're often written by not native English speakers. These are often from other countries, so there's grammatical problems and things like that. There are a lot of patterns that sort of crop up in truly fake stuff that is identifiable, and there are programs and nonprofits and sort of media academic groups that are building, you know, sort of bots to find this stuff, and that's certainly a useful thing. Of course, it goes the other way, though. You can use machines to write stuff, and they are not great. My, like, fantasy football Monday morning recaps are usually hilarious when I find out what, you know, there's, but, like, that's, it's being, the systems are getting better and better. More and more, the kind of, you know, first-year analysts working for investment banks don't really, they don't do what they used to do, which is write reports on companies. That's mostly bots doing that, that are crunching the numbers from earnings reports and doing it themselves. So just as you can now sort of, you know, hopefully identify some of this stuff, you can also train computers to write this for you. And just, you can, you know, flood the zone with, you know, fake stories written at scale to influence, you know, whatever it is. And yeah, it's very much a part of this question of, like, what we, where we all live. And I think that one of the things that's tricky is there's been so much profit in these technical fields. There's been so much emphasis on STEM in schools, and rightly so in many ways, but we're now running into these problems that have nothing to do with engineering for optimal efficiency on one variable. These are big, complicated human problems. You know, I think about Facebook coming in and disrupting the media and doing away with all these, like, unnecessary layers and bureaucracies and all these things. And there were certainly inefficiencies that were in these worlds, but there were also a lot of gatekeepers that were there to prevent horrible things from being published, from, you know, crazy, violent people from having platforms and putting things out into the world. And now, all of a sudden, the sort of efficient disruptors are facing the same problems that their inefficient legacy predecessors dealt with. And it's a really tricky balance. And I don't think, you know, when you hear technical founders of these companies, you know, sort of ask these questions about impact and influence and all this stuff, they say, well, yeah, we're looking at it. It's a real problem. We're digging in, and it's just year after year of the same, we're looking at it, we'll get there. Because I think these are people that are not necessarily trained for this, and we don't sort of, you know, push these sorts of things. It's not how you get at the top of that world, by thinking broadly about implications. And so I think we're very much in that place, and whether it's government or, you know, customer revolt or what have you, we're going to see what happens.
Yeah, I think fake news is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we are today at the point where AI algorithms can write fake news stories that are virtually indistinguishable from something written by humans. We're close to the point where they can create photographs that are indistinguishable from reality. We're probably 5 years away from a video that's indistinguishable reality. We're probably 6 or 7 years away from live action, where somebody could video conference you, you think it's the real person, and it's an AI. Or they could call you on the phone, and it sounds like your mom or your dad or your son or your daughter, and it's an AI, and use that for what we call in my industry social engineering, which is trying to steal your data live. And today people do it with humans. You know, it's a human that's calling you or faking you or emailing you or whatever. Imagine once it's bots that can call you and are indistinguishable from human beings, or you watch a video on the news and it's, you don't know if it's real or not. And it's going to be a war between those who can create content that looks real and those who can detect content, whether it's real or not. And I think it will be harder to detect than it will be to create. So this is something that we will have to put resources into, because, you know, what we've seen in terms of fake news and the proliferation of untrue information through our society is going to get worse, exponentially worse. We're just at the very cusp of this problem right now.
Jason, please, no more spoilers for your next sci-fi novel.
Sorry.
Please, come on.
Sorry.
Awesome. So Sarah, I actually have two questions that I'm going to throw to you, and then we'll kind of open it up. And the first is directly related to your research, so I think you'll like this one. So the first is, please comment on explicit biases built into AI systems designed largely by white males. Is there recognition of the consequences and any initiative to change?
Okay.
Tough one.
So I think the thing that concerns me the most is not, you know, yes, there are people out there, I'm sure, in the world who are trying to build biased AI, and that's like a purposeful, intentional thing. But I think that the more imminent concern is the ways in which AI systems deployed around us. Like I said, they're a lot of these systems are built on finding patterns, analyzing for trend lines, optimizing. And so what that means is that as AI systems are deployed in the world around us, what they're going to do is reflect and amplify the stereotypes and biases in the world around us. And those might not be so visible to us. So, for example, a lot of times the data sets that are used to train AI systems are scraped from the internet. And those data sets may not be representative of, you know, the people on whose lives are going to be impacted by those systems. So I think that is an imminent concern. And in my research, what we did was to basically sort of trace out this feedback loop. And we identified that there's a lot of work being done to identify biased AI. You'll see it in the news on a regular basis, you know, the soap dispenser that can't recognize darker skin pigmentation, speech recognition systems that, like, the early ones, like, were trained primarily on male engineers' voices, so they literally couldn't hear women. It's gotten better, but it's still an issue. So you'll see these instances crop up regularly, and those are visible. And there's groups of engineers that are working on those problems. And a lot of times trying to diversify data sets, solve for like statistical equity, sort of tweak things in the data. So that's one body of research out there. Then there's another body of research out there that's looking at issues of diversity and inclusion and bias in the workplace itself. And I think that this question sort of points at that, that AI as an industry, based on the data that we have, is, well, first off, computer science is not a particularly diverse field. In 2003, the number of women working in computer science dropped below 1960 levels. So it's pretty bad and it's getting worse. AI is worse than computer science overall. So some recent data, I think at the top three machine learning conferences, I think only 18% of authors were women. If you look at the people who are teaching AI, 80% of AI professors are male. We don't really have very good statistics on race, but there was one really excellent machine learning researcher, Timnit Gebru, was at one of the leading AI conferences and counted 6 African American people in an audience of 8,000 at the leading conference in the field. So the disparities are really, really significant. So we see work in that space, but what we don't see is the sort of the connections between those two. And it's in that messy interstitial space that I think we most need to be paying attention and doing the research, trying to understand where and how are AI systems being developed and trained, and how do we start to fix them. And I think it's going to be more than just the statistical applications, although that's really important and there's really sophisticated and critical work being done there. But I think it's situating in a broader context and trying to understand the incentives that are fueling biased AI, because the consequences are really, really significant and they're already affecting our lives.
And we learned today that the first programmers were women, right, for the ENIAC machine. But not for the reason you would expect. Like, it wasn't that it was a less sexist society. It was that the men thought the hardware was cooler, and they worked on the hardware, and they delegated the software to the women.
Well, I mean, the earliest computers were women when it was people that were doing the calculations on pen and paper. And it was when computing professionalized and, you know, in the post-war era, when computing all of a sudden professionalized and was treated as a domain of expertise, that it became masculinized. So this is an active construction. As soon as it became privileged work that people were attracted to, women were essentially written out of the field and relegated to administrative roles. They were excluded from ability to be promoted. And there's a number of good histories. Mar Hicks's Programmed Inequality is one that I would definitely point to for anybody that's interested in that. But yeah, there is a long history of women doing really critical work, and women and women of color and people of color in the field as well that are written out of this history. And I think it's really important to, attend to that, because I think we see its legacies today.
Yeah, and this is nothing new. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard of the term redlining, which is a real estate term, and it refers to essentially the banning of different ethnic groups from various neighborhoods. This was created in large part by the Federal Housing Administration during the Depression. There were huge numbers of foreclosures and bad loans during the Depression, and they wanted to come up with a numeric, accurate, unbiased way to deal with this. And through bad data sampling and then a lot of some accidental, some intentional racism, what basically happened was, if you lived in a neighborhood that had above 10, 15% non-white people in it, you couldn't get a loan to renovate your house. What comes off of these largely unintentional things that happen, these massive consequences, and then you get really bad actors that start coming in. People start realizing how the data works, and you had what they used to call block busting, where real estate agents would come in and start scaring white residents that there were black people moving in, and they better hurry up and sell. You get into all these, so you have these really bad actors that are floating around. It's not caused by bad people initially, but when there's a dollar to be made in a capitalist society, someone's going to do it. And I think that this pattern kind of happens over and over again, where there's an attempt to be more efficient, to improve things, to be less biased, but these things get built into the systems unintentionally. And I think it's even harder to understand when you're talking about AI, because so few people can understand red lines on a map. They can understand 10% of the neighborhood is of a different race. Dealing with these deep neural processing systems, that's it's really sort of privileged information, it's hard for people to understand or engage with it.
Yeah, and a lot of it's protected by trade secrecy. You can't even get access to the data. Even when you control for, identity characteristics in your variables, you might see proxy variables. So an example of that, Facebook has advertising that it serves up to you whenever you're on the platform. And there was a study that came out last year that found that for housing and employment ads, so two areas where there's a considerable amount of anti-discrimination law, Facebook's optimization systems were essentially leading to ads for higher paying jobs being served up predominantly to white men, and lower paying jobs and less attractive housing being served up to women and people of color. And this wasn't because it was coded into the system by engineers or by the people that were posting the ads. This came through the logic of optimization. And it's only in the outputs that was recognized, and it's now the basis of a lawsuit against Facebook.
And it's important to remember that AI algorithms have no sense of morality. So they will just optimize for whatever you tell them to do. If you ask them to serve up these ads, and they're going to do what they think is most effective and most optimal without any sense of the public good or what's good for people. And many times that's true of corporations too. It's not just AI. Very few corporations operate their business in a way that's necessarily for the public good over their own revenue. And that really becomes the area of policy. And that's the role of government, is to think in terms of what's the public good.
Yeah, so I think it's really critical that we be wary of something called automation bias, which is this characteristic that we're all completely prone to, which is the notion that a technical system is going to be better or fairer or more efficient or less biased than humans will on their own. And certainly we humans are biased too. It's not to say that that's not the case. But just that a lot of times AI systems are marketed as better at addressing bias than people are, and I think the evidence shows that not only are they not better at it, but that they just reflect back and amplify at larger scale the biases in the world around us and in ways that are sometimes much harder to see.
So a similar thread, but also maybe exploring sort of the paranoia surrounding the robots are coming to take our jobs. Okay. What advice, and I'll open this up to whoever wants to take it, what advice do you have for middle-aged women re-entering the workforce in the face of AI advances?
So I don't know if I have any advice. I'm not going to presume to give advice. Maybe other panelists will have some insight there. But the one thing I would say is, one of my major concerns about AI and automation is the continued hollowing out of the middle class, because I think when you talk about automation and AI coming for the jobs, it's not coming for the very low-paying jobs, because they tend to be more menial and physical and not something AI can necessarily do. Maybe in the future with robotics they will. And it's not coming for the very high-paid jobs, which tend to be more strategic and cerebral, and still at this point require human insight and wisdom that AI is not there for yet. But it's coming for the middle. And that's anything from truck drivers to radiologists to accountants to paralegals. And the number of jobs that are going to be affected by AI is astronomical. And I mean, you'll hear people who are boosters of AI say that each one of those jobs will be replaced by something else. And I don't see it, because I'm not seeing it happening now. Like, I think this trend of automation is what has driven in the past 10 years a lot of the income disparity and the separation of the rich from the poor that we've been seeing in the last 10 years that has reflected in our society in terms of strife and divisiveness and crazy partisanship in politics. And I think that the rise of automation will continue those trends. And so my wish is that, we could use AI to reduce strife and divisiveness, and maybe like applying it to hate speech, as that question asked, would be one way of doing that. But so far what I see is AI amplifying, to Sarah's point, amplifying those trends. So my advice is be ready and be aware of what's happening. And beyond that, I don't know what the right answer is.
What about, just to broaden the question a little bit, what about young people? What should we be encouraging in the face of this coming wave of AI? which potentially represents this new inflection point. What should we be telling young people, our young sons and daughters?
Yeah, so I run a company of essentially reporters for hire. It's a very difficult industry to make a living in these days, but companies need more and more content and writing and editing and research and things like that. So that's what we do. And it is a company that is largely filled with, we are definitely majority women. I would say it's a very high percentage of middle-aged women, many of them moms, many of them part labor force, getting back into the labor force. I think it applies equally. My point is going to apply equally to different groups, is that in a world where things are being automated and where these things are happening, I think, you know, sort of playing to those human qualities. Like, I love hiring moms because they've dealt with real problems all the time, coming at them from every direction. and these are you know, adult humans who've dealt with things and have been able to balance a lot of different variables and difficult situations and things like that. And I think that that's one thing that in the workforce is going to be increasingly important as we talk about a lot of these what we've considered to be high skill jobs are just not going to exist. And by the way, that is going to include a lot of coding. A lot of engineering, if AI works like we expect it to, a lot of basic coding and computer engineering is not going to be a job anymore. Computers will do it themselves. It takes on, and so I think thinking about not like maximizing our computerness, right? Our sort of like point by point logistical, operational, technical efficiency. All those things are always important, but thinking about what makes us humans and what the skill sets that we have as people who are, you know, that experience can be a good thing. It's not, you know, it's not just, you know, you want to look for it. I think emphasizing those things in the job force is a very real thing. At least it is for me. I don't know to what extent I reflect other hirers, but I think we are going to see these pendulums swing, and I think we are going to see a little move back towards that. With, you know, I love adults, you know, who have a long track record and understand a lot of different things, and maybe that's, you know, I wonder if that's going to swing back.
Hire moms, guys. I do have some thoughts for the first question. So one is, after the panel's over, I will tweet out a report. I can't remember the name of the group that put it out, but there's a really excellent report that looks specifically at how automation is going to impact women across different age and demographic categories. I will share that later so that folks can take a look at it. One other thing that I would suggest is looking at how AI is implicated, not just in, like, you know, the future of work, but how it's shaping access to work. So the uses of AI in influencing hiring practices, from the use of AI in parceling out and scanning resumes for keywords, that's a very common practice, particularly, and it's sort of different according to what sort of tier job you're at, but many large companies are using resume scanners, and they're looking for specific keywords, and so understanding that for your particular industry is one thing to consider. AI is also sometimes used to analyze, you know, your facial expressions if you're doing a job interview over video. AI is used sometimes to make recommendations about what salary to give you. So I think just being aware of how AI is implicated across different aspects of the hiring process, I think, is useful for folks who are re-entering or who are entering for the first time the job market, because you can, essentially, it's unfair, but you can optimize yourself for the algorithm. The third point that I would make, though, is given that, you know, the advancements of automation are occurring alongside the shift toward using, you know, gig work and contract work rather than full-time employment, I think, you know, We're seeing moves toward unionization. We're seeing moves toward advocating for stronger social welfare systems to support workers. And I think that that's an important consideration as well, that some of these things are not going to come from the companies that are doing the hiring. They need to come from the social nets that we form around ourselves and in our communities and that we ask of our governments.
Yeah, and I do think it's a policy issue. I think that's spot on. And I love what you said, Joe, too, because I think I was thinking about the advice aspect, and you know what it comes down to is what is uniquely human. And I think the winners in tomorrow's economy are generalists, not specialists, and people who are creative. Because I think in those creative fields and people who are generalists, AI becomes an augmentation to what their work. So like, you know, three people doing kind of drudgery work will be replaced by AI plus one person doing the creative work. So that's something to you know, kind of look out for.
Great. So I suspect we have some college students in the audience this evening. Go Cats, go. Yeah. All right. So these next two are going to be kind of geared at that. The first one is, and I'll kind of pair these together and then we'll open it up. Jason, you might want to take the second one of these because it's interesting related to you. First part of the question, are the humanities protected from the creation of AI, or maybe for the impact of AI? That is, could AI ever become able to paint with the skill and intention of Picasso or Van Gogh, or create any sort of art, be it music, calligraphy, theater, and match the qualities of a human creating those sorts of things? And the second question is, given that CS is a major of choice on college campuses, what is the contrarian major for those looking to take advantage of AI? Yeah.
I think on the, you know, doing high-end artistic creative work and things like that, I think if we do reach a time when, you know, AIs, robots are doing that, the fundamental structures of society are really, really different. Because those are some of the hardest things possible to automate. Now, painting gets into, there's rules-based things. Music certainly is probably the easiest art form to do this with. But we've progressed to we're not talking about like there's no more long-haul truck drivers. I don't know what people are doing at that point at all. I mean, I really don't. And so it does seem possible, but that's a real question though, and I think that we have to face. You know, you think about, and a lot of government changes, things that we think of as second nature to government now, were driven by technologies. You know, you think about something like disability insurance. Disability insurance is a result of the factory world, which was a new thing. There was a time, certainly people got injured working farms all the time, but grandpa with his bad back was still useful on a farm. He had enormous amounts of information and knowledge and management skills and things like that that could be useful. No one's helpful with a broken back in a factory floor. They certainly weren't 80 years ago. And so we built a societal system that companies and individuals paid into as a form of insurance for when the downsides of technology and new economic structures kicked in and really hurt people. I don't know what that is right now. I certainly think, I mean, healthcare is a good example. I work with a lot, most of the people who work for me are freelancers. And, you know, things like Obamacare are incredibly useful because people can go from state to state and not lose their insurance. They can go from job to job and not lose their insurance. They can do these basic things. They can be dynamic and creative while not having to worry about everything going south because, you know, they got hit by a cab or because they had some, you know, diagnosed condition, pre-existing condition. So I think that's going to be a huge part of it, is what regulations and things we do to deal with these downsides.
And I mean, I think what you're pointing at is like we're at an inflection point, because for the entire history of capitalism, wealth has been primarily tied to human labor. And from this point forward, wealth will become more and more disconnected from human labor. It will be those who own the automation will be those who own the capital. It will not be those who employ people. And that's something that changes the entire foundations of our society, and that, you know, we have to come to terms with. And unfortunately, you know, government policy reacts and follows. So we're going to have some disruption and some dislocation before we come to terms with that and figure out how to get there. And there's, you know, definitely people thinking in those terms. I mean, Andrew Yang up on the debate stage is already thinking those terms. Like, he's not going to be president, probably, but, you know, he's thinking in terms of automation and thinking in terms of, you know, guaranteed minimum income. And that's not necessarily the solution. I don't know what is the solution, but those are the types of thoughts we need to have, that we need to restructure the way we think of our society when wealth and access to resources is no longer tied to the labor that you're doing as a human.
So So we desperately need humanities people. Like, there are a lot of companies that are like, those are the folks that we need the most. And a lot of people in the tech industry think that as well. And I think one of the reasons why we desperately need people with backgrounds in the humanities is because the humanities can allow us to put a wider frame on what we're seeing in the world around us. I think that a lot of times we see what's sort of framed as technological progress as inevitable. A lot of the trends that we're describing up on the stage are actually still fairly recent. They're only like a century old, maybe two centuries old, if that. Sometimes they're only a decade or two old. History is really critical for making sense of our times and also regaining the sense that we actually can shift things. And I'll give you an example. So AI Now every year puts out this annual report where we kind of are scanning what's going on in the field and making sense of how AI has changed. And when we were working on the report last year, facial recognition was an imminent concern. And a lot of folks in the space thought, like, facial recognition is everywhere. There's no turning back that clock. Like, it is in the world around us. We are too hooked on our Face ID and our Snapchat, like, and it's just gonna keep booming. We since then have seen San Francisco, Somerville, Cambridge, like cities around the country are enacting bans on facial recognition. We have a lot of capacity to change the trajectory of history and to change it in a direction that is, you know, part of a public conversation in the direction that we want to take it toward. Now, on the question of art, I mean, I think that there is absolutely value for human-created art. I think that there's a lot of, like, really beautiful AI art out there as well. But I think that the role of the humanities is, if anything, only going to grow as time goes on.
I agree with that. And in a previous AI symposium, I got to talk with the guy from Google who leads the team that does AI algorithms for musicians. And what he said was that he's not trying to replace musicians because, first of all, it's just not a problem that's interesting to him. What he wants to do is augment musicians. So the kinds of tools they're building are, you know, you're a guitarist and you lay down your track and you record your music, and then they have a tool that can create a drum beat that goes with your music. So you don't need to go find a drummer, and maybe or maybe not it would be as good as a human drummer, but it's pretty good. Like, they generate drum beats that are based on all these professional drummers that they've recorded, and they've created algorithms out of it. So, I mean, you could say maybe it's replacing that drummer, but really what his focus on is making people who are creative more effective and have more fun and be able to be more creative. And so as long as I think the AI is focused on that, then, you know, there's a great future for the humanities and for creative people who are creating art, because it's another tool in the toolbox.
I think it also speaks to, you know, we're sort of framing the creativity thing around here around consumption in a sense, right? Like, we consume art created by humans and we pay them for that. Are we going to start consuming art created by robots and then pay the owners of those robots for that? I think there's also a question around just the act of creation. I mean, people have been creating since, whatever it was, like 15,000 years ago, when the guy with the broken pinky put his hand in the caves in Lisette, France, and put his personal, you know, you can see his broken hand in these 10,000-year-old cave paintings. We've been doing this forever. No one was paying him. And no one was paying, you know, so I think that there's an interesting question around, you know, art is so suffused with sales, money, popularity, and things like that. If we get to a world where this many jobs are being, you know, taken over by robots, I think we're going to have a fundamental shift in how we value work, consumption, and things like that. I mean, it is interesting that people who have money and have the ability to do things do a lot of analog stuff, right? The fanciest, most expensive cities in America, you find a lot of artisanal butchers who are doing things that people were doing 70 years ago and then got really untrendy, and now they're trendy again. You know, like, there are these interesting, how these shifts come about, I think are really interesting. But the very nature of work and our relationship to it changes whenever there's a new technology, whether that's enclosing pastures in Great Britain in the 1700s, or factories replacing, you know, like, skilled craftspeople, whatever it is. And we're in the midst of one of those things.
What about on the other side in terms of educators? What advice would you give to educators on how to restructure curriculum for the technological needs and innovation in those academic curriculums? Jason, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think everyone should have an understanding of computer science. And maybe I'm a little biased in that. But I think that if you don't understand the role that technology and computing and AI plays in the world, then you are blind to a large part of how the world works. And so that would be my recommendation, is start early, start in middle school, and start teaching computing. Teach it in high school. It solves two problems. I mean, one is that I think we just need general awareness and education in computer science in general. And then on top of that, we do need diversity in the field. And we lose women and we lose minorities because by the time a college is recruiting people for computer science, it's too late. You need to introduce people to computer science very, very early, so that by the time they get to college and they think about computer science as a career, they already have that background and comfort and fluency in it. Because the first year of any computer science curriculum, you lose most of the women and most of the minorities, because if you don't come in with a background, you don't come in with some fluency, you feel behind from day one. Because every computer science class in the freshman year of college is a double bell curve. There's the set of kids, and it doesn't matter how smart you are, there's the set of kids who have not been exposed to this way of thinking into computer science, and the set of kids who have. And the tail end of the kids who have will intersect maybe with the front end of the kids who haven't, but the kids who haven't been exposed to it feel lost, and they feel stupid, and they drop out, because they're like, this is not for me. And it's not because they're not smart, it's not because they couldn't do it, it's because they weren't introduced early enough.
I think that's a really critical point. I think it's critical because, you know, if you look at the studies on sort of the computing pipeline, which I think, you know, is only part of the larger problem. It's also a problem of who gets recruited, how do people's skills get valued, once they're in a company, what are their experiences like when they're in the company. There's a lot more there. But if we're just looking at education, in kindergarten classrooms, in people's homes, who gets access to the computer becomes gendered, and it becomes racialized very, very young. And that has significant downstream effects. Now, educators can adjust for that. Carnegie Mellon University, which is one of the top programs in AI, made adjustments to its computer science curriculum because it realized that women were dropping out, and they looked at it closely, and they realized that there were certain courses where people started dropping out, and exactly for those kinds of reasons. And they adjusted their admissions criteria, where early on they required programming languages as one of the core criteria, that you had to have some proficiency in certain languages, and that was tested. They took that out. They kept the test scores, the GPA, other kinds of criteria the same, and they significantly diversified their population of students. They also made adjustments to how students were entered into different classes, what the expectations were of their students, and it had significant downstream effects. And I think it's a real success case in that there are spaces where you can make really meaningful change. It doesn't, again, address what happens to those students when they graduate, because that's a whole other can of worms, but yeah.
I've got a question I'm gonna ask the audience. I wanna actually pull the audience on this one. Raise your hand if you believe that AI could someday fight our wars and possibly replace our soldiers. Show of hands. Okay. Survey says, I don't know, about half-ish, 30% maybe?
Yeah.
Panel, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's really creepy. But yeah, I think it's probably true. And I think, you know, the discussion, you know, we talked about this earlier, is, you know, it's already in very serious discussion about letting drones make kill decisions autonomously without their operators. And you can make the same argument for the drone making that decision as you could for like a hiring AI to make the decision on hiring, except for one is a little bit more life-changing than the other. I personally feel uncomfortable about that being an autonomous decision.
Yeah, I think the question is, do we want it to? I mean, that's definitely been on the cards for decades. I think that personally, my answer is no, but
I mean, I would say my experience, technology is already fighting our wars. But there's always a decision maker on the ground, even, you know, today on any operation that happens.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because Iran shot down one of our drones. So, like, we have, you know, it's not a war, but it's an aggressive action against a piece of equipment that has no harm to humans. So you can say that was a positive thing versus shooting down a fighter jet, right? Mm-hmm. And our counterattack was a cyber attack, which, again, didn't have any loss of life. So, you know, on the upside, there's ways for us to continue to take out aggression on each other as nations without loss of life. You know, the creepy thing is the Terminator 2, mm-hmm. you know, kind of equivalency. If we have robots out there shooting humans, then I, for one, get very nervous.
Yeah.
Well, and you also have, when that spreads over, you know, there's this interesting change in, like, warfare statistically between times when, you know, it's majority soldiers who were killed to civilians being even numbers to being much higher numbers of civilians killed. And I think you wouldn't be surprised if on the technological warfare front you see something very similar. Right now, cyber attacks tend to be things like messing up Iran's, you know, nuclear software programs and things like that to put their missile programs back, you know, behind by X amount of time. But it's just as easy, actually easier, to just wipe out a grid. And all of a sudden, hospitals don't work. You know, lights don't work. ATMs say, money? What money? You know, like, these are things that, you know, and very quickly, that becomes a situation where it's primarily not aimed against the military in many cases. It's just a straight-up attack on civilians. And so these things are, you know, they're very real and very possible. That said, there is this interesting thing with AI that's like, We criticize it both for being too good and for not being good, right? So we have these dual fears of, like, you know, those Tesla machines are going to kill everybody on the roads by you know, because the robots are going to run people over, and also they're going to take the jobs of drivers. It's like, well, which one is it? Are they bad at this or are they better at it? And I think that's an interesting question, you know, that goes back and forth, because you can read old Rand, you know, the official first military think tank documents from the 1960s, the nuclear strategist talking about how presidents would never make decisions about whether or not to launch the big one within a couple of years. Computers will be much better at this. And this is in like 1963, or like Pong was 25 years away from being invented. We didn't have the computing speed for that, but we're going to decide whether it's smart to launch a nuke at Moscow. I mean, so there's been, you know, talk of things forever, and where this plays out, it's, you know, and it's that interesting thing. It's scary when things are bad and scary when they're good in very different ways.
It could be both. They could take our jobs and run us over.
I mean, here's the thing. It's not just bad randomly, it's bad in particular ways. You know, if you take the autonomous vehicles example, computer vision software has lower accuracy rates for people, for women and women with darker skin pigmentation. It has a hard time recognizing people who have disabilities. It has a hard time recognizing children. So if an autonomous car is going to cause a safety question, it's not a safety question where, like, the harms are distributed evenly. They're actually distributed quite unevenly. And that is a moral question. And that is, I think, a really significant issue. And I think when we bring in, you know, military decisions, man, on moral grounds, absolutely not. And on, like, the software being good enough to do that, also absolutely not.
The morality of autonomous cars, I think, is fascinating, because even if they're perfect, let's take the imperfections out of the system. People who are writing the software for autonomous cars have to, like, legitimately think about the trolley problem, which is, if you're in a situation where you have to kill a pedestrian or kill your owner, what do you do? What do you do? I want to buy the car. Most people would probably want to buy the car that will protect them, right? But maybe somebody sells a car in which the selling point is that it would protect the pedestrian. I don't know. Or the car flips a coin. Yeah. Is this an area where we need policy to define the ethics of autonomous cars instead of letting every car manufacturer make these choices for themselves, right?
Yes.
It's the new Chevy Monte Carlo. It randomly decides who to kill. Right, bad math joke.
Don't tweet that. Oh, wait. This is being recorded. No, I'm just kidding. So we've talked about war. We've talked about education. We've talked about the workforce. I like this question because it gets at something that's often kind of where my mind goes, is what can we use AI to do to better nature, to better the environment?
So my personal hope is that AI will solve climate change. My fear is that it's going to make it worse. I think the jury is still out on that. But, you know, if there is a chance of us engineering our way out of climate change, then AI will be a partner in that. So that would be my answer. That's the most pressing issue, I think, when it comes to thinking about nature and ecosystems, is what is the impact of climate change? How do we mitigate, and then how do we adapt, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, we see this every day, actually, with things like smart homes. Right, we do it to save money, right? So that, you know, that the house heats and cools at the proper time, and we don't waste energy and things like that. You know, when those things get scaled out to massive electrical systems and grids and things like that, I mean, there are enormous efficiencies to be found in these things. There's also ecological things that are interesting. You know, one of the biggest causes of environmental damage is an inability to see multiple angles at the same time. You know, we build this thing and it does it, and that's it. And then it turns out it kills off some animal that is kills off 25 other animals that are deeply related to it in the food chain. And AI, because it is it can be a much sort of broader take of variables and things like that, I think there are real chances for ecological complication and understanding that they could bring to the table. But yeah, I mean, it's the new technology that got us here. So.
I mean, I saw one study the other day that I thought was really interesting that, like, looked at, it was an AI system that looked at where there is open space on the earth where we could potentially plant trees, and found that there's actually, you know, wide swaths of land that we could use to reclaim forests that have been destroyed. So there, I mean, there are definitely some positive uses there. At the same time, the carbon costs of data centers is really significant. Every time you train an AI model, it has a massive carbon footprint. And so that's a significant environmental harm.
So I want to be respectful of time here. I've got, by the way, if anybody knows an AI algorithm that can sort question cards, cue me about that, because this is tough. Oh, this will be the last panel I ever moderate. There will definitely be a box here next time. So I've got three kind of fun questions that I'd like to end on. And let's try to keep them kind of rapid fire. The first is, please respond to the following. Because we can, should we?
Maybe.
That's not spoken like an engineer, Jason. Come on.
I'm older and wiser.
Not always.
Not always? Okay.
Yes with a but, no with an if.
Ah, I like that, Joe. Very nice. Okay. The next fun one is, what has surprised you? It says recently in the field of AI, but maybe just more generally, what has surprised you in the field of AI?
The Google Duplex demo really got me. And it, for anyone who's not seen it, that's the one where the Google Voice Assistant can call and make an appointment for you. And I think the example was, they call a hair salon, and it's the Google Assistant is talking on the phone with somebody, and the human on the other side who's taking the appointment never knows that it's an AI bot. And it's not ready for prime time or in general use, but they're getting there. And so that example of AI that really was indistinguishable from a human, you know, in a normal kind of day-to-day interaction, was, for me, pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, kids. I don't have kids myself, but I've started to see friends with young children, and Alexa's just an invisible person. I mean, it's like what you said, Les, about, you know, thinking the sock puppets on Mr. Rogers were real. I mean, they don't distinguish. It really is just another character in their life. And in some ways, their favorite one, because it does whatever they ask. It doesn't tell them not to watch TV. It makes the TV work, you know? And I think that brings up all kinds of crazy questions about our brains and development, and how do we perceive something as being something we would empathize with and something we wouldn't? And like that's been a big. I'm fascinated by watching kids with the Alexas. It's cool.
I mean, I have to come back to my theme of the night, which is AI as humans. So I didn't know this until I read, I'm going to give another book plug, but there's a really great new book called Ghost Work by Mary Gray and Sid Suri that I highly recommend. And in that, they found that when you use your Uber app or your Lyft app It runs on APIs that essentially often when you plug in a destination, that query goes to a human who is located in some time zone around the world that is within seconds helping match you to drivers. And that runs on Amazon's Mechanical Turk API, which is everywhere. And that I thought was fascinating, that Mechanical Turk is essentially a real-time marketplace for making a lot of AI systems run.
And awesome. It's amazingly cheap. Like, if you go to Mechanical Turk and see, like, the tasks you can do, it's these simple tasks, you get paid, like, a nickel. So it's truly, like, the automation of humans doing work, right, drudge work.
Yeah, who's working for who there?
Yeah. All right, so the last question that we're going to end on is actually two-part, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to go through on the first part and then go through on the second part. So that's going to be the format. The first part, and I'm going to tell you both parts ahead of time. So the first part is there a sci-fi novel, film, or TV series that depicts AI technology in a way that you imagine the future will look? And the second part of the question is, what is the actual future of AI?
Oh, man. You know, it doesn't directly depict it. I'm kind of discursive. I like the side pieces. I like footnotes and things like that. But Dune, for anybody who's read the Dune books, there's this whole thing where they banned computers. That, like, there's this backstory about how computers are sort of taking over in a sort of, you know, Terminator Matrix-esque way, and that they had this, you know, enormous war, and they beat back the robots, and then they're using the Dune spice, the kind of core thing that it makes people able to do massive calculations so that they can, you know, warp speed through space and things like that. So it's humans doing it, aided by this spice that comes from the planet Dune. I can kind of imagine a world in which we do have some kind of retrenchment or, you know, fight back against technology. Maybe that's from a regulatory perspective. Maybe that is from a much more sort of, you know, physical sense. But that's one I kind of imagine that you could see happening is not that the technological, that there's not, you know, Moore's law moving forward constantly, that actually we move backwards because something terrible happened and there was a pushback against it for whatever reason. Yeah.
So one of my favorite sci-fi books is Children of Time, and it's AI is not the theme of the book. It's more a theme about genetic engineering, but AI is, there's definitely AI included, and it's one of the main characters progresses from human to AI over the course of centuries. And the whole book is very, very intelligent, but the way it approaches AI, I think, is great. So yeah, there you go.
I really like Jorge Luis Borges. His short stories, like, all they sort of like capture little bits of the world. And there's one, I'm gonna butcher it because I'm very jet lagged. But there's one that's about the map of the world that, you know, is so intricate and it's detailed that it takes up the entire space of the land that it was meant to cover. And that's one that comes to mind.
I'm actually, you know, my answer, can I answer this one?
Yeah.
I'm surprised nobody said this one. And it's A River Runs Through It, actually, is my think on that one for a second.
I love that book.
Back to the river. Back to the fishing. All right.
We can all fly fish all the time while the bots do all the work. We're in the right town for it.
All right. So what is the future of AI? What do we have to look forward to? What are the pros? What are the cons? What does the future hold?
I think it's so hard to say because you know, right now we're in the midst of exponential progress. And it's very human to project what we see today into the future and think there won't be any major inflection points. So if you project what we've got today, then in 100 years we're at the singularity and we're all integrated into computers and we live forever. The reality of it is probably not going to be that, right? We will, at some point, and probably in the near future, we're going to hit the limits of current AI techniques of neural networks and deep learning and genetic algorithms, and we're going to plateau again, just like we did in the 80s and 90s. And Sarah introduced me to the term AI winter, which is, you know, that what that plateau is called. So we probably will reach some limit. The the amount of buzz around AI will diminish, the huge claims of what AI can do will kind of recede into the future, and we'll all settle into our new kind of idea of what technology and society is. And then 10 or 20 years from then, we'll be blown away by something that will happen that will come out of left field in terms of AI tech, and we'll be on the roller coaster again.
I think really what's driving what will happen with AI is what happens with us. As a society, as a political body, as an economic structure. You know, I think that a world in which, as you pointed out, technology and AI have hollowed out the middle class in a lot of ways. If that continues, I think the world that we know will be the kind of polarization we're seeing and things like that we're seeing, the anger that between groups, things like that, will get much, much, much worse. And I think that a lot of, who knows where that goes. If we use these technologies and these improvements in, the efficiency of labor and things like that to actually spread some wealth, I'm not talking about this is not sort of like a massive redistributionist, kind of thing, but, you can put taxes on things. You can use the market to do this, so these sorts of things. But I think that's a key difference. I mean, if we have a more middle class society because of technology, that leads in one way, which is probably fairly stable, fairly reasonable, in a lot of ways. If it moves us towards further economic polarization, I think we're going to see more disenchantment and anger, and that leads to all kinds of who knows what. So I think that the ways that we handle this as a society, and whether we, how we legislate and do things like that, is really going to drive the technology, because for now anyway, it's still us building it, and we can ban it, or we can, have a war that results in no one being able to do this stuff anymore, or we can, we can do what we want. For right now, anyway, and I think that's going to be the big question.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be perfectly candid and say that I have absolutely no idea. But I have no idea, I think, in the hope that it is something that we are going to construct. And whether it's in, local community politics, where we see a lot of movement, whether it's in litigation that's brought to the courts and class action suits, whether it's people who are sort of trying to take back the reins within their workplaces, and we see a lot of work organizing that's going on in the tech worker space. I mean, we didn't really get into this, but who is a tech worker, I think, is a question that really implicates all of us. It's not just something that implicates, people walking out at Google or protesting at Facebook or at Tesla. I think in a lot of ways, all of our work is being intermediated by technology, and we all have a stake in this fight. And so I'm hopeful that through organizing, through engaging in politics, through discourse, and advocating for a change, it will be a future that we actively construct rather than sort of see constructed for us.
Fantastic. I just want to thank you all for an amazing evening. Thank you for the authenticity, the insight. What an amazing group, huh? Can we hear from them? Amazing. No AI will ever be able to replace this, right?